Good evening, everybody. This is James McKenney with my Science Hour for April 21st, 2022, in the ongoing series, the year-long series of programs dedicated to talking about my history of discoveries and with adventures, if you want to call them that, or misadventures, as the case may be. So this week I'll be talking about some of the history of the Velikovsky affair, because it was during this time after Cornell that I found out about Velikovsky. And so I entered this whole bizarre world, which that's the only term I can use. So I'll be talking about that and trying to put that into perspective a little bit, and talking about some of the people that did really great summaries of those days, like Charles Ginnenthal, for example. Very objective, rational discussion of that whole issue. But I'm going to start out by talking about the magnetic propulsion systems. Now, as I have said before, if you did not understand about electricity in outer space and electric fields and electric currents and magnetic fields and all of the things that go with it and how they work, where they are, where they're located, so you can use these, you would never in a million billion years, or in the universe, the age of the universe, whatever it might be, you would never imagine designing, let alone building, an electromagnetic propulsion system to move around in outer space or in the Earth's atmosphere or around other celestial bodies. It would not occur to you, because it would be like building an ark in the middle of the continent when you never saw an ocean before, or something, you know. But anyway, and of course Noah did that because he knew that the great flood was coming, but I digress, excuse me. So anyway, what do I do with this? Now, I've been in Canada just becoming a warrior, as I said, probably more like 10 months in the wilderness, and just it does something to you. That's all I can tell you. And I'll just give you a little anecdote about the first time when I was young, I was able to drive, and my grandparents had a cabin up in the North Woods. And so I went up there, and I was by myself for the first time, you know, away from home, away from the family, and I was by myself in this cabin in the woods. And the first night I was there, I kind of cleaned it up, got everything together, and it was so quiet around sundown. And this cabin was on a lake, it had a little dock that went out into the lake. And it was very deep there. It wasn't like you could walk into the lake. It was a drop-off right offshore. I mean, just straight down. You could not see the bottom right at the edge of the water. And so anyway, I was there, and the sun goes down, and it's that twilight time, and the lake is absolutely still, and there's not a breath of air moving at all. And I'm in the cabin, I'm cleaning up, and I start hearing this noise, this kind of rustling noise. And so I start, well, you know, is there an animal in the house here, or the cabin? Or is there some kind of, what's going on? I'm hearing this. So I stop and listen, and there it is. It's constant. And I start looking around out in the kitchen area. It's just kind of like a one big room cabin with a heater, and then a couple bedrooms off in the small bedrooms off in the back. And I'm like, I can hear this, and I stop and I go around, and I'm bound and determined to find out what is making this noise, because there's no noise outside. It's perfectly quiet, perfectly quiet. And so I'm going one bedroom. No, I don't see, or it's not there, you know, can't hear it there very well. So I go into the other bedroom, and I can hear it. So at least I've isolated it to this one bedroom. And so I started looking around, and there on the floor was the bucket that I had been using during the day to clean. And it had suds in it, had some soap suds in it, and it was the bubbles breaking, the soap bubbles breaking in this container, this bucket. That's how quiet it was. That's how attuned your light senses, your hearing senses, your senses become when you go out into the wilderness. All of a sudden, things that you would have never, ever in a million years noticed before become highly, I mean, this was something that I was very much hearing in my audible range. Okay, and then I could talk about other events like seeing people's auras in a very dark area. Okay, so anyway, this was some of the experiences I had when I was young, and then the time in Canada, and then also being when I was in Mexico, I spent time out in the wilderness, a very different kind of wilderness, out in the desert myself, or in jungle areas by myself. And so it's something that, but that very first time when I was up at this cabin by myself to complete the story, I was very nervous. I was very wary. Was a bear going to come out of the woods and eat me? You know, I mean, was there danger around the corner? And you have to become confident in yourself that even if it were pitch dark, you would be able to manage the situation no matter what the situation would be. Okay, so anyway, I come back from Canada. I'm now back to civilization. I go out and I get shaved and cut my hair and buy nice clothes and go out looking for jobs. The very first job interview I went to, I got a job. And this was not just any job. It was a really, really nice job. And I talked about that last week, working with the telecommunications company. And so anyway, then I sat down, and of course, I'm certainly not one to sit idle. And so I started working on, I said, okay, the best thing I can do here is go out and get funding for my electromagnetic propulsion system. So lo and behold, the way this turned out, I'm not going to go into a lot of details, but a person that I knew had been associated in one respect with the CIA and got involved with some people in Los Angeles. Now, little did I know at the time that the CIA was the police force of the World Bank and who they were. And I really, you know, it didn't occur to me, nor was it important. These were just people that knew businessmen in Los Angeles. And so they made arrangements for me to go out there as this mad scientist, you know. And of course, in those days, I was well known in the tier one levels of science. My name was well known, let's just put it that way. Anybody who was involved in those levels knew who I was. And so anyway, I go out to Los Angeles and am introduced to a venture capital group and other companies, but turns out that one was, there was an association there of international investors. And little did I know it, but here I am walking into one of the offices of the international families that run the world international military-industrial complex. And so I'm there, and so in my time being there, I was in the office quite a bit in Los Angeles, and I might tell who this was eventually here, which office it was, which venture capital group. But it's really not important. And one of the key people was an old man. I'll just call him Francis. And he was in a wheelchair. Francis was in a wheelchair. He had had a stroke, but he was still very active. He was moved around. He had a car he could drive with the half of his body that was not seized up from the seizure. He would sit in meetings and call the shots. He was basically in charge of a lot of the military-industrial complex movings. Everybody in all of the aerospace companies in Los Angeles and down the coast, down to San Diego, in La Jolla, etc., all of these people knew him. And so he took me under his wing at the time. And so I got to go to lunch, I got to go to private meetings with top physicists who were going to vet my products, because they don't just invest in some guy who walks off the street and says, hey, I got this product. they are vetted. And so the people that were vetting me were people with a lot of experience, inventions, such as the brushless motor, things like that. People that knew about electricity, world-class physicists, but tier one physicists. These are not the kind of people you would find publishing papers in a peer-reviewed journal. These people were above that. They were in the tier one layer of science. Okay, so anyway, they're vetting my material, and it passes that. So they go through the vetting stage, and it gets the okay. These physicists are going, yeah, this guy has invented an electromagnetic propulsion system. And at that time, I just had one. I eventually did invent a second one, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But you can see the design for this one, which actually came from a talk I gave in later in the 1980s at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference. And you can see the reprint of that paper. It was an IEEE publication in my book, Atlantis to Tesla. So if you page into there, you'll see a short paper talking about the magnetic propulsion system. And this is the active one. There's another one, which is a passive one. The second one is a passive one in which you don't do anything. But this one, and the beauty of this propulsion system is it's non-inertial. In other words, I've talked about this before. You have, let's take a swimmer, for example. Let's take a swimmer versus a squid swimming in the ocean. What does a squid do? A squid takes in water and then it ejects it out the back end like a jet engine to make it go forward. That's a form of propulsion. That's an inertial propulsion system because the squid is jettisoning material to make it go forward. A rocket that goes off from the launch pad going up in the air is an inertial propulsion system because it works on inertia. It pushes in one direction, and this goes back to Newton's law of physics and inertia, that an equal and opposite, there are equal and opposite reactions to, so if you push something away, if you're a skater and you're on ice and you push away from something, then you will go backwards, and then literally the thing you push on goes backwards in its direction a little bit also. Typically it's a big building or something and it's not going to move very far. And but anyway, those are inertial propulsion systems. A swimmer, a person swimming in the water, does not eject anything. They are working against a medium. And so that is a non-inertial propulsion system because the swimmer's muscles are expending energy, pushing against the water, which is a medium. And so it's a non-inertial propulsion system. So the swimmer does not have to carry propulsion matter with him. He carries energy. He ate a good lunch, or she ate a good lunch. And they swim. It's an action where you're pushing against a medium. That is a non-inertial propulsion system. So my electromagnetic propulsion systems were non-inertial, which means you don't have to carry mass. And that's the big problem with a rocket, is when you take off from the launch pad with your rocket, then you have to carry a big payload of rocket fuel. And that rocket fuel becomes payload because for a good part of its journey, the rocket fuel is not doing anything, so it's payload. It's taking the place of payload because you have to lift the rocket fuel as well as the rocket and the payload with an inertial system. So a non-inertial system is very nice. And so what happens in terms of physics, if you're a physicist, this is gives you a high specific impulse, it is called, and it's in units of seconds. It's kind of, if you're not a physicist, then you would have a relatively hard time understanding. But this is the way you compare propulsion systems with specific impulse. And so anyway, and you can see a chart of this. If you look in my Atlantis to Tesla book, The Colburn Connection, you can see that. And by the way, that book was the book that I released in a public talk in 2003 at the International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada. I gave a talk to about 1,200 people, and there was a contingency of Tier 1 scientists at that. I'll talk about that later. But anyway, when I was in 1982, going back to the original dating here, I was already in Los Angeles. I came back from Canada, got my nice job. I'm working as a professional engineer in the telecommunications high security job, and I'm out in Los Angeles all of a sudden marketing my magnetic propulsion systems, the specific one, a non-inertial system. And so the issue is that this was the first real bona fide non-inertial magnetic propulsion system that they had seen. So I went to a lot of private meetings and gave talks on this to propulsion experts. Now, the other thing that was going on at the same time, there were other types of electronic propulsion being proposed, like the ion engine. Many ion engines have been built to date and used commercially on spacecraft, etc. So I'm going to these meetings with the venture capital groups, and there's a meeting where they're going to flesh out the company. And I'm starting to get the drift of what's going on here, and I'm starting to smell, let's just say my BS meter is starting to go off, and I'm going, wait a minute. All I need is a number of, say, $5 to $10 million to develop this system with engineers. I don't need a company built around this. I don't need all of this other peripheral baggage in this company. But this is what these people do, the venture capitalists. And this is the way they squeeze your invention out of you. They build this company, they build up all around it, and then they put money into it. And by the time it's all over, you don't own anything. They own it all. And it's just a mechanism of squeezing. I'll talk about this, how I saw other engineers lose their inventions because of this. Well, let me just give you an example right now, because I met other engineers in the process of going through the venture capitals and the groups. And there was one specific one who, a young engineer who had done design work. And I don't want to get too specific here because I don't want to identify who I'm talking about. A lot of people would know because it's a very famous inventions. But I'll just say that it's dealing with the aerodynamics of high-performance jet planes. And I'll leave it at that. But anyway, there were a number of very critical inventions that were made relative to at the time, the high-performance, the Navy jets, the F-14s at the time. And what happened is that invention allowed the jets to flip sideways, shoot their ordnance, and then come back to flying straight again. And this invention allowed them to do this. And there was that's all I'm going to say. But this guy's invention was basically lifted from him by the same technique that they were using building this corporation around me in my inventions. And in one meeting, I'll mention this also, there was a group of people there. And a lot of these women, the meetings had, it was like in somebody's condominium down in Rancho Verde or Palos Verde or someplace, you know, where a lot of the rich people lived there. And so there was the wives of these investors there also. And they started talking about the militarization of the product. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I do not want my invention delivering nuclear bombs, because here I am. I have a conscientious objector status. I had an appointment to the Naval Academy, which I turned down, which nobody ever does. I talked about that in the previous discussions early on this year in my history. And I told him, I said, I don't want my invention delivering ordnance and nuclear bombs specifically, because what I invented had the capability of hypersonic speeds. And in other words, minute deliveries, a few minutes delivery from the United States to Russia. And of course, at this time, I believed that there was a difference between Russia and the United States. And if you know what's going on in the world, this will come into play to understand really what's going on. And so later I understood that this is one of the things I want to point out. I get back to the guy's invention dealing with the high-performance jet planes. This should have been absolute top secret in the military of the United States, as well as my invention, as well as other things that I saw. And there are scientists who are working on highly classified projects. But here's what happened. The same guy, Francis, that I'm talking about, and he's long since passed away, so I don't really have to. Anybody in these inner circles probably knows who I'm talking about. Anyway, he took that invention and he took it to Russia. He was an arms dealer. And he sold it to the Russian, basically engineering, to the tier one science in Russia. And this is when I realized the tier one science branches the international boundaries, the Russian, the Chinese, the U.S., the British, the Japanese. Top-level scientists in the tier one science region report up the ladder to the bankers who control all of these countries. And so, and that is the way they control these countries, is they maintain the balance of power. If there is an invention in one country that would give it a superior edge in military prowess, then that is immediately moved by these families into all the other countries. And the reason is because if any of the other countries would tip the scale of balance and go out of the bankers' realm of control, it would be easier for the bankers then to fund all of the other countries to go after the renegade country and get rid of that leader who did this. And now this is going on as I speak, as we speak right now in Russia, as you can see this going on. So there's this chatter about regime change. That's what it is. These other countries are controlled by the bankers. Putin is removing, and this is not taking sides with anybody, good or bad or anything else. This is what's going on at the very high level. And so, getting back to this, the next year, this is how fast the Russians were able to put this technology into their MiG fighter systems. The next year, the MiG fighters at the Paris Air Show showed that exact same development. And so when I saw this happening, I contacted this engineer that I had met. I called him up on the phone. I said, "Did you see what happened?" He goes, "Yeah, I know. There's nothing I can do about it. But that if I play the game properly, then my future projects," which he was ahead in the works, he was a very good engineer, tier one engineer, "his future projects would get funded and he would have a lot more control as an engineer." But he understood that he had to bite the bullet and not complain. Well, I complained right up front. I said, "I don't want my electromagnetic propulsion systems delivering nuclear weapons." And from that point, the conversation went cold. It went cold. And from then on, Francis' job was to keep me at bay, to tell me, "Oh yeah, we have funding, it's going to be here next week, just be good." And then next week would come, and he'd say, "Well, there was something, we had some problems with that, but we got a better deal on the table now." This guy did this for the better part of a year. And then I realized this guy's, you know, giving me the runaround. And I realized that everything that had happened, they had taken my work and they put it into the aerospace companies. They basically stole it from me, moved it into the aerospace companies, and developed it. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. I eventually found out about one of the Skunkworks companies that was working on this. It was a group located in La Jolla, California. So I went into their office one day. I went in and I asked for the lead scientists. One of them was a NASA scientist who took my project, and because he had the ability to get funding, got funding through his company, and they were developing my project. I walked into the building and I told the secretary, "I want to talk to so-and-so." And at this time, like I say, everybody knew me. The secretary knew me. I'd never seen her before in my life, but she knew me. And I walked into the office and I said, "I want to talk to these." And so the guy comes out, young physicist, and brings me back into his office, and we start talking. I sit down. He's very cordial. And I'm looking around, and I see my project proposal, my exact project proposal, on his desk. My proposal on his desk, and they have gotten funding from the government to do my project without me. And so when I noticed that, this guy got real offended. And then, oddly enough, one of the techs from the other room came in, from their laboratory, came in, and he had a long quartz tube that they were working with to, because my part of my propulsion system dealt with quartz tubes. And so you can see that if you look at the Atlantis to Tesla book. So they were developing my project using my proposal and getting funding from the government, and knew who I was and knew that they were stealing it from me and didn't care. So I'll tell you a little bit more about this company, and anybody in the industry will know who this is. They happen to be working on something called the Tether. This was a long carbon filament that would be let out of the space shuttle. And the idea was that originally was that if they dragged this long cable through outer space through the Earth's magnetic field, it would generate a current, and they could power potentially power things in the space shuttle, use it to generate electricity, because a wire or conductor, which carbon would be in outer space, a conductor moving through a magnetic field would cause an electric current. So that's what the proposal was, but they changed it to do the reverse, to drive a current through this cable to act as propulsion, as a mechanism of propulsion. And that was how they were stealing part of my work and part of my idea. And so I knew about this, and so I confronted them, and I said, you know, what you're doing here is not a good idea. When you let that tether out of the space shuttle, it's going to discharge the local electric field, and you're going to have a big discharge on your hands. And I said, they were talking about letting it out many kilometers. And I said, no, you let that thing out a little ways, and it's going to discharge the local electrical batteries that I knew existed in low Earth orbit around Earth. Well, they finally got their chance on the space shuttle. They took it up there. They let the carbon fiber out of the space shuttle doors, and it didn't get out there more than a couple hundred meters. And boom, they discharged the local capacitor, blew one of the doors off of the space shuttle. It blew out all of the computer systems, and they were able to get back. They were able to close it back up and land that space shuttle without any deaths, without any mishaps in landing. And they were able to load up a backup computer to do the computerized part of the reentry, because not all of it is manual. When they're coming in initially into the atmosphere and for part of the way down, it's computer controlled. And so they were able to land that space shuttle, but that's what happened. And I told them, I warned them. So maybe that's a method, that's some kind of cosmic justice coming back on people who would steal somebody else's idea, get funding, make their living off of it, and right in your face, steal it. So now I want to get back to the point of the international families. And what I realized in this office, this venture capital office in Los Angeles, there were all people. They were from Ireland, there were Arabs there. There were literally all countries of the world had people involved coming through, passing through this office. And I realized at this point that I had stepped into this group of families. These people were related, although they were from many different countries. And the thing that really keyed me off was at the very beginning, I walked in there and there were these young people. They were like, you know, 25, 30 years old, maybe. Obviously, very well educated, very well groomed. And the guys had beautiful wives. They drove the nicest cars, you know, all Ferraris and sports cars, very well dressed, every day a different, you know, $1,000 suit. And I saw these people pick up a phone and call a congressman and say, I want $5 million in this company over here tomorrow. And it would happen. And I'm like, whoa. And I'm watching this go on. And I see these people calling. These are the people being trained. These were the trainees, but they were the kids of the people who were in the venture capital group. And the venture capital groups were moving daily $10 million, $20 million into these companies that they were forming in Los Angeles. And of course, all of these revolved around the aerospace industry. And the and like I said, but my question to myself was, how did, you know, I must have gone to the wrong college. Where did these kids go to college that they get this kind of a job? And then I realized this is not a job. This is the families. These are the families that have the connections that are in those upper loops. And really, to understand also, they were not the top families. These were not the, these were the worker bees. These were the people that made millions every day on the war industry. And they were hidden families. You would not see their names. You would not hear about them. You would never see their name in a in any kind of public setting at all. They're invisible. I'll just give one other anecdote here. A number of years ago, there was a person from these families, who a guy who wanted to drive a submarine. So they made arrangements, and I think it came through some congressional okays and down the line, and they got, they made an arrangement for this guy to pilot a submarine, and his, what he wanted to do was to do a breach, like a whale, come up to the surface, the submarine comes up and comes slamming down into the water, like a whale. And so this guy wanted to do this, and he was in one of the families out there. So anyway, they make the arrangement. He's piloting the submarine, and he's coming up. They breach, and they come up right into the middle of a Japanese student research boat, cut it in half, and kill a lot of the students. I don't remember all the statistics. A lot of people died and were either died or were badly injured. And they fired the naval captain of the nuclear submarine. This is a nuclear submarine this guy was taking on a joyride, mind you. And of course, this would have never come out. And of course, there's all the other famous incidents of like George Bush Jr. Carrying his helmet Top Gun style with the pilots, and he took a flight in one of the high-performance naval airplanes off of the deck of an aircraft carrier. And so anyway, this is, these are some of the benefits of being up in those families. So the Bushes, the Clintons, the are families that are up in these levels. They're the worker bees. They're the people who make things happen. And so anyway, I'm not going to dwell on this too much longer, but the point is eventually over my career, and I always say things that when I am on radio shows and I talk about things, it's not because I read it on the internet. It's not because I read it in a book or something or somebody told me. It's because I experienced it myself. I saw it. I was there on the front lines, and I understood what was going on. So that's where I met the families and understood secret society. So it was about, when my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, came out, one of the subtitles in the title of the book is Dealing with Secret Societies, and you can go read that. The title of that book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and I talk about secret societies. And when I released that book on Coast to Coast AM, secret societies was not a common term. Now it's a daily common household term. And so the talk show host asked me, he said, what is a secret society? And I said, well, these, I gave a short explanation. But throughout my career, I've also been on radio shows with people like Leo Lion Zagami, who is an expert. He was associated with the Vatican and understands the history, the tremendously long and deep history of the secret societies that eventually had taken over the Vatican Bank and the front agencies, the Rothschild banking industry, etc. So what I saw firsthand was the result of the families that run the military-industrial complex from a monetary point of view. Tremendous benefits to them. And then also, I understood, because of the connection with the CIA, I also understood at the time the whole Iran-Contra affair was actually going on. This was before it was discovered. This was before Reagan. And the people in the meetings, the engineers, etc., were talking about this openly, about the about Noriega, about the drug trade with the arms, the Iran-Contra affair, and all of the other issues that eventually emerged. I had seen this in these meetings because these were the same families that were putting money down into Central American and Latin American countries to control them. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to go on a lot about this. I could go on for hours and hours. I could fill many shows. But the point in discussing this is that I got a firsthand view of the international arms trade, the CIA involvement in controlling information and misinformation in the United States, the connection that they had to the World Bank, and the World Bank connection to the Vatican Bank, which is the hidden part of it, and the Jesuits who had taken over a lot of the universities in the United States by this time, etc. So it's a very complex background. And so here I am, once again, I step out of the, as they say, step out of the frying pan and into the fire. I'm coming out of Cornell, which is the bastion of corrupt government-funded science, and into Los Angeles, which is the industry side, the aerospace industry side of that. So anyway, eventually I had to basically distance myself from these people because they were just plain evil, just plain evil. And, it's hard to explain. So here I am coming out of Canada. I have renewed my spiritual life, my mental conditioning, my physical conditioning, and I'm all of a sudden confronted with these groups of extremely evil people. That's the best way I can say it, because they have no conscience. The arms dealers have no conscience. Money is their god. Money is their motivation. And the fact that this causes absolute destruction and suffering around the entire world makes no difference to them, because they are living the high life, the life of the money is not an issue, because in a lot of cases their travel, etc., is they're flying on private jets. I'm going to stop here talking about that, because I want to get into a different topic that's very important. When this is a very big shift in the time period here, when Solon, which was Aristotle's uncle, went to back to Egypt. This is back the ancient Greeks were developing. They were a young, intelligent, very intelligent group of people. They had developed the first democracy or republic form of government. And, they went back to Egypt because the Egyptian culture was much older and they knew it. So they go back and there's instances where they took up classes with the Egyptian high priests. And we know who they went to. That's on the record. At one point, Solon asks the Egyptian secret society priests, what is the history of the Greeks? And the Egyptian priests, they respond and they say, well, you don't even know what happened. You don't know your true history. This is where they talk about Atlantis, the continent of Atlantis. Atlantis and the Greeks, these are the Greeks before the Venus event, basically, were at war. An international war was going on, and the Greeks were starting to win. They were starting to overpower Atlantis. And that's when one of the shoe drops in Atlantis went under the ocean. It just sank one day. And we know that the Phoenician sailors used to come in through the Strait of Sunda between the sister volcanoes Krakatoa, what we now call Krakatoa, and its sister volcano, which is completely gone now, it blew up. Krakatoa has had some many major eruptions. But the two pillars were the pillars of Hercules, were the pillars of smoke and flame and lightning that could be seen from hundreds of miles away out in the ocean. And so the mariners would come in and they could find the channel into the passageway that led into Atlantis. So Atlantis is under the ocean in the South China Sea. And interestingly enough, when I released my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, where I talk about that, and finding that on a web page where it was a secret submarine base in northern Australia, and I found myself in that web page, and they were excavating Atlantis, much to the chagrin of the Chinese government, because at the time the Chinese government had no power to stop the U.S. Navy. So the naval submarine base in northern Australia, one of the things they were doing was going into the South China Sea and excavating Atlantis. And of course, you're not going to hear about this on the evening news, nor through the Smithsonian or anything else. This is all hidden, as they are now exploring Antarctica and the remnants of probably an Atlantean colony there. So there's a lot involved here. But I wanted to go back and talk about this because the secret societies have overlapped thousands and thousands of years. And I talk about this. It's something that I have learned about myself. And, for example, the Peri Reis map that Columbus had was an old Phoenician sailing map that showed the coastline of Antarctica. And that's what Columbus was looking for when he sailed south and went west, trying to find the coastline of India, because he was looking for the passageway that really would be there if the Antarctic ice cap were not on Antarctica, as a passageway to the Far East, but going west. Okay, so at any rate, the secret societies that were in Egypt at the time, the Osiris and the other you wouldn't call them, the secret societies is the best term you can use, carried on into the future. And the method of enslaving people in a country where you come in, you take over, you basically come in and you take over the news media, you take over the low levels of government, etc., and you work your way up. And as you work your way up, you fill below you with your own people. And that's what happened in the United States. They've already successfully completely taken over the United States. And then you institutionalize banking. And through banking and through amortization, the mortgages, etc., with interest, then you take over a country and you eventually enslave the people. And that's what happened. That was the Babylonian captivity. This is how the Israelites were captured into bondage into Egypt. And of course, it was the big event with Venus coming through the solar system that took Pharaoh out, because Pharaoh couldn't manage something that was from outside. And that's why you come up to today, the biggest fear of the international bankers who are in control is that there would be a large comet that would come through the solar system and the public would wake up to this and they would lose their power. They would lose their power because the public would look up and say, I don't have to pay my house payment, my insurance payment. I don't have to worry about the jobless rate. I don't have to worry about the war here or the skirmish over there or anything else, because these people in power, the bankers and the government and nobody else, can manage this thing up in the sky. And so that, of course, when we fast forward into the Planet X days, mid-1990s on through, and of course, with Harrington discovering this in the early 1990s, and the CIA taking over the NASA, setting the stage for the next dozen years to unfold. And of course, my work is right in the middle of this, because what is my work about? About comets. So no matter which way I turn, I seem to be always involved in the middle of a major international a group of people who are trying to suppress my information because it threatens their power structure. Or if you go fast forward to the work I did on prime numbers, I'm not going to talk about all of these things right now, but it just seems like every time And what am I doing? I'm a mathematician. I'm a physicist. I'm solving problems. I'm understanding how the universe works. And I'm the best to my the electromagnetic propulsion systems. Everything that it seems like everything that I do, I end up in the middle of a giant controversy, and people don't want me around. But then the other half of it is, and this is I've been told also by tier one scientists, to just keep doing what I'm doing, and that they are learning from what I'm doing. So don't stop my discovery patterns. And I'm just going to take a minute out here also to mention something called Rhodes Scholars. Now, Cecil Rhodes, long time ago, 100 years ago or more, decided that he was going to start an organization in London to bring back the United States under the British flag. And so he, under Oxford, he organized what are known as the Oxford Scholars and the Rhodes Scholars. And so anyway, they went to the United States and they took people and plucked them out of the United States and they brought them over to Oxford to educate them. And what they did was they educated them in how to bring down the destruction of the United States. So you find that Billy Clinton, you know, Susan Rice, I could go on and list thousands of people in government who are currently active and have been active in government who are Rhodes Scholars. And they work with impunity. And you'll find that a lot of these people have committed basically serious crimes and are never prosecuted. And that's what they're told when they become a Rhodes Scholar. You go back to the United States and we have your butt covered. You're not going to be arrested. You're not going to be, whatever you do, we're going to protect you because you're doing the bidding of bringing the United States back under the crown. And what is the crown? The crown is the British branch of the Rothschild Banking, international banking firm. It runs out of London. And so you find that China was under London. You find that India was under the British rule. You find that, in fact, the expression that the sun never sets on the British Empire is true, and it got this power because of naval superiority and because of the Rothschild Banking Empire. So anyway, I don't want to go into, I could go on and on and on about the connections here, but today a lot of the situations in the world are a result of this. And the people, the younger people of today, have no idea about any of this. They have absolutely no clue why what makes the world go around. Getting back to science and my work, I've always worked as an independent scientist, but the real tier one science that is organized spans international boundaries. It spans the countries, it spans the governments. And the governments can come and go, etc. But the science, the international bankers understand that what makes things tick is understanding how the world works. And that's why they have Tier 2 science. The Tier 2 science, the Carl Sagans of the world get notoriety. You see them. Those are the Tier 2 scientists, the scientists at NASA or their visibility that you see, etc. These are Tier 2 scientists. Tier 1 scientists never publish in peer-reviewed journals. Tier 1 scientists are not visible. You will never see their face or names. And they're plucked out of these ranks. And I've seen young people come up. I'll see them at, say, American Geophysical Union meetings where they're a bright young physicist or woman. And you know that they are going to be in the Tier 1 level of science at some point. And when they are, they sign a document that they have signed their life away. They are working under total secrecy, and what they don't realize, they may realize it at some point in their career, is that they're working for the international bankers, and those are the people up on top. Their work goes up, not down to you. And so the entire gamut of international scientists in Tier 2 layer, their entire purpose is to feed garbage science to you, the public. And, of course, what I do is I have seen Tier 1 science. I've been there. I don't work. I've never signed documents with the government. I've never been employed by them where I had to sign documents. I've been my entire life, my entire existence, an independent scientist working on my own. And so just trying to give you a feeling for this, and going back to the year 1982, this is on the beginning of my road to discovery of all of this, and how the world is to put together, and who's running it and who's operating it, and the war machines and how they balance, how the international bankers keep their control because of funding. And a good example is the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in the early 1900s. The international bankers funded both the Bolsheviks, the Reds, and the Mensheviks, the Whites, funded them equally up to a certain point. And at a certain point, they said, we favor the Bolsheviks, the Reds, and we're going to fund them, and we're going to restrict funding from the Mensheviks. So the Mensheviks couldn't get arms, they couldn't get bullets, they couldn't get warm clothes, they couldn't get what they needed, and easily the Bolsheviks came in and wiped them off the planet. And of course, killed the Tsar and destroyed the Russian, the form of government that was, not that it was wonderful in Russia, but Russia was one of the richest countries in the world at the time. Fabulous amount of wealth, etc. And of course, they had their peasantry also. But the Bolsheviks brought in, and they used the Russian Revolution to power the people to think that they were going to come out of this and have something better. And wow, all I can tell you is it didn't work out good for the hometown team, the Russian people, nor the Ukrainians, who all the way up into the 1930s were starved to death. As the Bolsheviks moved in to Ukraine and took it over and basically replaced the peasants. The Ukraine was the richest country. So Ukraine itself has gone through many iterations of going back and forth, east-west, east-west. And it would behoove most people to understand the true nature of what happened in the Ukraine around the year 2010, when it was then switched over with a coup to Western powers, and that's where we come up to today. But it's important to talk about that because it all goes back to the arms industry that oversees this and has no interest in the local populations. Their suffering, their devastation is of no consequence to the international arms dealers or the international bankers who oversee this conflict. Okay, so switching gears again, going back to the electromagnetic propulsion system, the non-inertial propulsion system with a very high specific impulse, meaning that you get a lot of movement of payload. So here's the layman's definition of specific impulse. It's how much payload can you carry given the amount of energy expended in the propulsion system. And the reason rockets and other jet engines or ion engines, etc., the reason they're down low on the chart is because they have to carry propulsion material that they heat up by some means and eject out of a nozzle by some means. So it's in one sense the energy source and the inertial mass that is thrown out of the device to make it go in the other direction. But in a non-inertial propulsion system, you don't have to carry any matter. It's like the swimmer. The swimmer is not carrying matter with him to eject to go out. He's working against a medium. The electromagnetic propulsion systems work against the magnetic medium. And like I say, if you didn't know that these were there, or how they worked, or how they formed, or how the electrical currents worked, or where the electrical currents came from, you wouldn't even dream of inventing something like this. So this was the point I'm at in 1982 in my career. And once again, here I'm in my very early 30s and experiencing this. And now also I want to talk a little bit about the whole issue of something that's going on that's called disclosure. It's something right now, it's big in the news, where people are looking for the government to disclose information that the government may have on UFOs or aliens flying little spaceships around Earth. The invention that I had, the magnetic propulsion system, you will clearly see is the mechanism for driving flying saucers. And it explains all of the different phenomena that you see. And so some people have asked me, when I've been on radio shows, etc., if I have ever seen aliens, or if I've ever been close to them or seen, had any experience. And the answer is no. I have no personal experience with anything related to aliens. I'm friends with people who are involved in some of those search efforts, but myself, no. I have not seen or anything. My work relative to inventing the electromagnetic propulsion system was purely scientific, understanding the electric fields, the magnetic fields, and how to interact with them, and how to create the devices that will, in fact, move you around in outer space, given electromagnetic fields that I know exist because of my theoretical work dealing with the electric universe and the functioning of the universe, electrically, magnetically, etc. And, of course, there is gravity involved here, too. So when people talk about anti-gravity, it's really not anti-gravity. It is a force that's working against gravity. It's not like you put a bubble around something and gravity disappears, because gravity works through, literally through anything. And that's one of the very interesting things about gravity, is that it seems to permeate space, including the space that is occupied by other matter. But be that as it may, the end result is that the electromagnetic propulsion system is not anti-gravity. It's a force working against gravity that causes something to, like an airplane, the aerodynamic lift of the wings is one of the forces, and then you have either jet engines or propellers that propel it and cause the air flows over the aerodynamic wings to cause it to fly. And in outer space, of course, you don't have any atmosphere, so you don't have the aerodynamic lift, but you have other things. You have magnetic fields, and there are different, there are similarities. The other thing that I've talked about this before is with the electromagnetic situation in outer space with the electrical currents, they tend to pinch and concentrate around objects. And, for example, a comet is a perfect example of that. And so the end result is that you have a concentration of current on a given point, you know, it's a point spacecraft. Interesting. I'm about out of time. And so next week I'll talk about some of the incidents regarding my ventures into the world of the world of Velikovsky, which, like I say, I didn't know about when I was at Cornell. But when I entered that, it became a very strange experience. And I'll try and put that into perspective next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.